Femi Kude with DJ Rich Medina at Fillmore New York at Irving Plaza. Richard James Band, The Now, Snacks at the House, Colin McShane at Sullivan Hall, and Phil Minasalli at Live in the Lobby at the Patch Oak Theater. And if you have any gigs to tell us about, email us at scene, that's S-C-E-N-E, at WUSB.FM. And thank you for listening to the Concert Billboard and to WUSB in Stony Brook.
And it's just about 6 o'clock. You're listening, as you just heard, to WUSB Stony Brook. It's time once again for another exciting edition of Off the Wall. Be right with you. I'm downloading a file. Thank you. Okay, terribly sorry about that. I had to download a file, and, you know, I don't know why the connection here is so slow. I swear I was getting better connections on a consumer cable line 10 years ago than we get here on campus. I was actually, I wanted to ask the listeners for their help because, everybody came through so nicely last time I did this. I played something over the air, and I asked if people could identify it using those little gizmos that everybody has these days where they simply hold up their iPhone to a speaker and it immediately tells you who recorded it, when they recorded it, where they recorded it, what they were feeling like when they everything is labeled, neatly categorized. And it's very helpful if you lose track of something, if you have a song or some kind of piece that you just don't know the origin of. And that happened to me over the weekend. I was listening to the newest edition of The Voice of Long Island, actually, as aired 28 years ago this very weekend. What I do is I listen to the shows as if I'm listening to the first time. Of course, I actually remember doing the shows that long ago. I heard this one song that I really would like to know who did it. And I tried looking it up on the internet. I even had a friend hold an iPhone up to the speaker and see if they could identify it. No luck. No luck at all. So what I did just now is download the high-res version of the radio program, which you can hear yourself at www.2600.com/voli. That's V-O-L-I for Voice of Long Island. We'd love to hear your comments on that show as well. Even though it's 28 years ago, don't think that your comments are any less apropos today. You can email us either at the email address for this radio program, otw@2600.com, or webmaster@2600.com. Either one works. And love to hear your views. I know a lot of people are downloading the shows all over the world, and it's amazing because when we did those programs in 1981 through 83, we thought maybe we had five listeners. We probably did just have five listeners. But now all of a sudden, all these people all over the world, people who weren't even born at that point in time, are listening to these programs and getting something out of them. But okay, now I hope to get something out of this because if we can just turn down the theme. Yeah, all right. What I'd like to do is bring up the musical piece I really would like to get a nice copy of. You know, I'll go out and I'll buy the CD or the MP3 or whatever just so I can hear this song properly. I mean, it sounds pretty good as it is. This is the quality that you hear if you download the program from our website. But still, I'd like to know who it is, for one thing. Let's take a listen. Oh, yeah, it's a reggae song, in case that offends anybody.
Operation by Mussolini, it was wrong. Invaded Ethiopia, killing us one by one. Occupation by Mussolini, it was wrong. And the orders came from the Vatican. 1935, 3rd of October, they crossed their borders, war in Ethiopia. A nation of 42 million attacking a nation of
That's the mystery song. If those of you with iPhones or other devices that can identify music, can please either call us in a little bit at 631-632-9872. Tell us who this is and what song it is, or write to us, otw@2600.com. I'll give you a few more seconds to hold your phones up to the speaker and use Big Brother technology to identify who it is. No, nothing like a song with a lot of history in it, and that's what makes me like this. Just wish I could remember who it was. You know, what I could do very easily is simply, well, not that easily, but talk to somebody at the station, Lister, Kubert, somebody like that who has all this knowledge in their head anyway, and beats the crap out of Wikipedia or Google or whatnot. So, yeah, we do have a better database in humanoid form here at the radio station. But let's see if technology and the WUSB listeners can come through in this particular case. All right, let's keep this on in the background because it is rather pleasant. And those of you calling, hold those phone calls until we take phone calls a little bit later on in the program, because we do have a little bit of ground to cover. When you might hear me in 1981 if I leave this going for too long. Speaking of Orwellian technology, you know, you've been following the story about the missing airplane, the missing airliner that went down between Brazil and France. Really disturbing story, obviously, whenever something like that happens, and it doesn't happen that often. Really, usually there's a reason that's pretty quickly defined, but in this particular case, it was just so bizarre how it happened. This plane takes off from Rio de Janeiro on its way to Paris, and then several hours later, just is missing. It's gone. And this is something I didn't know about. I really didn't think this was how it worked. Of course, I don't know very much about this to start with. But I'll look at this. We're playing a different song now. That's probably a lot easier to identify. That's just to tell you what kinds of things we did on that program. It's going to be very distracting. Let's just turn that down. All right, thank you. The way I thought it worked, when you got on an airplane, I thought they always knew where the airplane was. I thought it was always sending out little blips and beeps and things like that, you know. Satellites, GPS technology, radar, you name it. I just assume that you couldn't just make a plane disappear and not have any idea where it was. I mean, they were looking. They were looking in an area the size, three times the size of Europe in the Atlantic Ocean. That's what they were saying. Three times the size of, that's pretty big. As somebody who's traveled around Europe, you know, by train, it's a huge landmass, and this is a big sea mass. Now, as of this afternoon, they found some of the wreckage. They've confirmed that it is some of the wreckage. They weren't sure. They found a seat, an airline seat, and a life vest. Now, think about it. Who else? Don't you think they would know if another airline had lost seats somewhere over the Atlantic Ocean? So obviously, it seemed pretty clear to me that they had found it even before they verified this. But in the period before they did this, the only reason they were able to pinpoint it to this degree was because a pilot on the way over, and I think it was a day later or at least a bunch of hours later, saw some flaming wreckage, or what he thought was flaming wreckage, just bright lights in the water where normally you wouldn't see such a thing. Now, if that person had not seen this, they might not ever know where that plane wound up. And I just find it weird that we can walk around with our telephones, our computers, our cars, all of which have some form of, can have some form of GPS triangulation or what have you. They can communicate and send out, if you call the police, for instance, don't do this, but if you call the police from your phone, they can basically get your location information using various tracking technologies. It's all over the place. You would think an airplane, of all things, would have this information. You know, you're driving in a car. The car can tell you where it is based on reading from satellites. Obviously, an airplane can do the same thing. Now, here's the thing that really gets me. They sent about 10 automated messages, apparently right after whatever happened to the plane happened. 10 automated messages basically saying that the electrical system had failed and some kind of something had happened. Not necessarily a catastrophic event, but something had happened, and 10 messages were sent, I think via satellite or something. So the plane was still there, it was still able to send these messages, but the information that they did not send was where the plane was. Now, you know that they can download GPS information and say these are the coordinates where the plane is right now. Did nobody even think to attach that information to whatever message is sent out by that other automated system? Would be very handy to know. It baffles me that something like this is even possible. Yeah, and you know, it's Had it not been for that one pilot who happened to be looking down, I'm not sure why he was looking down. I guess you can look any way you want when you're flying a plane, because it's all pretty much automated, isn't it? You'd think the passengers would have seen flaming wreckage, since they have more time to look out the window and sightsee, especially if something happened recently in that area. But had it not been for that, they might not ever have known where this thing went down. And even with this information, even finding the wreckage, they still don't know exactly where it went down. The wreckage could have floated all the time that they've been looking for it. And it could be 2 miles below the water. And they have to find that black box. And hopefully the black box is in one piece and they can figure out just what it was that happened. It's also weird to me how immediately they're able to say, and I also question this with the Dominican airliner in Queens in 2001. How are they able to say so quickly that this definitely was not terrorism? I mean, I'm not one to jump to the whole onto the whole terrorism bandwagon. I really am not. But how is it that you can so quickly say, yeah, that's definitely not what happened? I mean, think about it. You have an airplane flying over the Atlantic Ocean, and somebody does something to disable the electrical system and blow the plane up in the air, and who knows? You don't know until you actually find out what happened. So you can't really rule anything out at this point in time. It does seem like they flew through some kind of crazy thunderstorm. Do you know they have thunderstorms at 55,000 feet in that part of the world? Because it's where all the trade winds get together, the north and the south. They all kind of hit, and all kinds of things happen. They should tell you this when you get on an airplane. They should tell you, by the way, your particular route will take you through this monumentally dangerous part of the world, or just where spectacular storms happen, where winds collide together, and boy, if it was Jupiter, you'd be able to see it from Earth. You know, things like that. You should know. You should know the history of your airplane. Oh, yeah, this airplane clipped a building once, and all kinds of weird, haunted-type things have happened on this particular vessel. You know, you don't even know what kind of plane you're flying half the time. They don't tell you that until you actually get on it. I just would like to know. Another thing I'd like to know, previous history of any airline that crashes. I should be able to look at this airplane and say, was I ever on that airplane? You know? Look at all the flights it ever flew. Just, you know, out of morbid curiosity. Or maybe somebody would have noticed something weird, like, you know, a gaping hole in the fuselage or something that they just didn't think was worth mentioning at the time. But, you know, seeing a story like this, it kind of spooks me, because you think things are pretty much covered. You think they've learned how to not make the fuel tanks blow up. You think they've learned how to not make the entertainment system create a spark that will destroy everything. You think they've learned about wind shear and birds and everything else that could possibly go wrong. And you sort of have this this feeling that it's the takeoff period that really is where things can go wrong, and, of course, the landing period where things can go wrong. But when you're up in the air, especially when you're up that high, unless, you know, you got the shoe bomber on board, there's really not much you have to worry about. And now, apparently, well, there it is. We don't know what it is yet, but there's something else. Something else out there. Wow. I mean, here's something I always wondered. What if a plane got hit by a meteor? That was my theory for TWA Flight 800, which nobody else picked up on. But what if? What if a shooting star just comes in through the atmosphere and bang, hits the plane? I know it's a million-to-one shot, but you know what? They have over a million planes going in the air in a time period, so even a million-to-one shot is bound to happen at some point. How would they detect that? You know? Meteors. Think about it. Is there any real defense against those? So, okay, it's going to be an interesting next few days as they try and figure out just where this thing is and what happened. You know, I was holding out hope that somehow there'd be like another miracle like they had in the Hudson River, where these people were just on a life raft somewhere. You know, you need to hear stories like that occasionally, just to sort of give you faith that survival is possible, even in the most extreme conditions. And it still hasn't been completely dismissed, but I think I might be the only person thinking that might even be remotely possible. But, yeah. Okay, so that's something that I noticed that I thought was rather interesting. General Motors, they're bankrupt now. Okay. Everyone's going bankrupt these days. It's the latest thing to do. I was wandering around the internet earlier, as I've been warned not to do many times, but I saw this amazing piece by none other than Michael Moore. Remember him? Michael Moore, Roger and Me? Yeah. Basically, did a film all about the auto industry and various bad business practices they've been involved in for a long time, not caring about their workers, things like that. And he wrote this letter that appeared on the internet yesterday that I think I'd like to read parts of it, if not most of it. It is with sad irony that the company which invented planned obsolescence, the decision to build cars that would fall apart after a few years so that the customer would then have to buy a new one, has now made itself obsolete. It refused to build automobiles that the public wanted, cars that got great gas mileage, were as safe as they could be, and were exceedingly comfortable to drive, and that wouldn't have started falling apart after 2 years. GM stubbornly fought environmental and safety regulations. Its executives arrogantly ignored the inferior Japanese and German cars, inferior being in quotes, cars which would become the gold standard to automobile buyers. And it was hell-bent on punishing its unionized workforce, lopping off thousands of workers for no good reason other than to improve the short-term bottom line of the corporation. Beginning in the 1980s, when GM was posting record profits, it moved countless jobs to Mexico and elsewhere, thus destroying the lives of tens of thousands of hardworking Americans. The glaring stupidity of this policy was that when they eliminated the income of so many middle-class families, who did they think was going to be able to afford to buy their cars? History will record this blunder in the same way it now writes about the French building the Maginot Line, or how the Romans cluelessly poisoned their own water system with lethal lead in its pipes, things like that. So here we are at the deathbed of General Motors, the company's body not yet cold, and I find myself filled with, dare I say it, joy. It is not the joy of revenge against a corporation that ruined my hometown and brought misery, divorce, alcoholism, homelessness, physical and mental debilitation, drug addiction to the people I grew up with, nor do I obviously claim any joy in knowing that 21,000 more GM workers will be told that they, too, are without a job. But you and I and the rest of America now own a car company. I know who on earth wants to run a car company. Who among us wants $50 billion of our tax dollars thrown down the rat hole of still trying to save GM? Let's be clear about this. The only way to save GM is to kill GM. Saving our precious industrial infrastructure, though, is another matter and must be a top priority. If we allow the shutting down and tearing down of our auto plants, we will sorely wish we still had them when we realize that those factories could have built the alternative energy systems that we now desperately need. And when we realize that the best way to transport ourselves is on light rail and bullet trains and cleaner buses, how will we do this if we've allowed our industrial capacity and its skilled workforce to disappear? Yeah. Thus, as GM is reorganized by the federal government and the bankruptcy court, here is the plan I am asking President Obama to implement for the good of the workers, the GM communities, and the nation as a whole. 20 years ago, when I made Roger and Me, I tried to warn people about what was ahead for General Motors. Had the power structure and the punditocracy, I guess is a better way to say that, maybe much of this could have been avoided. Based on my track record, I request an honest and sincere consideration of the following suggestions. Number one, just as President Roosevelt did after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the president must tell the nation that we are at war, and we must immediately convert our auto factories to factories that build mass transit vehicles and alternative energy devices. Within months in Flint in 1942, GM halted all car production and immediately used the assembly lines to build planes, tanks, and machine guns. The conversion took no time at all. Everyone pitched in. The fascists were defeated. You know, Mussolini and those people. Invading Ethiopia was wrong. We are now in a different kind of war, a war that we have conducted against the ecosystem and has been conducted by our own corporate leaders. This current war has two fronts. One is headquartered in Detroit. The products built in the factories of GM, Ford, and Chrysler are some of the greatest weapons of mass destruction responsible for global warming and the melting of our polar ice caps. The things we call cars may have been fun to drive, but they are like a million daggers into the heart of Mother Nature. To continue to build them would only lead to the ruin of our species and much of the planet. The other front in this war is being waged by the oil companies against you and me. They are committed to fleecing us whenever they can, and they have been reckless stewards of the finite amount of oil that is located under the surface of the earth. They know they are sucking it bone dry. And like the lumber tycoons of the early 20th century who didn't give a damn about future generations as they tore down every forest they could get their hands on, these oil barons are now telling the public what they know to be true, that there are only a few more decades of usable oil on this planet. And as the end days of oil approach us, get ready for some very desperate people willing to kill and be killed just to get their hands on a gallon can of gasoline. Yeah. President Obama, now that he has taken control of GM, needs to convert the factories to new and needed uses immediately. Number two, don't put another $30 billion into the coffers of GM to build cars. Instead, use that money to keep the current workforce and most of those who have been laid off employed so that they can build the new modes of 21st century transportation. Let them start the conversion work now. Number three, announce that we will have bullet trains crisscrossing this country in the next 5 years. Hallelujah! Japan is celebrating the 45th anniversary of its first bullet train this year. 45th anniversary. Now, they have dozens of them. Average speed, 165 miles per hour. Average time, a train is late, under 30 seconds. They have had these high-speed trains for nearly five decades, and we don't even have one! The fact that the technology already exists for us to go from New York to L.A. in 17 hours by train and that we haven't used it is criminal. Let's hire the unemployed to build a new high-speed lines all over the country. Chicago to Detroit in less than 2 hours. Miami to D.C. in under 7 hours. Denver to Dallas in 5.5. Why would you want to go to Dallas? Oh, never mind. This can be done and done now. Number four, initiate a program to put light rail mass transit lines in all of our large and medium-sized cities. Build those trains in the GM factories and hire local people everywhere to install and run this system. Number five, for people in rural areas not served by the train lines, have the GM plants produce energy-efficient, clean buses. Number six, for the time being, have some factories build hybrid or all-electric cars and batteries. It'll take a few years for people to get used to the new ways to transport ourselves, so if we're going to have automobiles, let's have kinder, gentler ones. We can be building these next month. Do not believe anyone who tells you it will take years to retool the factories. That simply isn't true. Number seven, transform some of the empty GM factories to facilities that build windmills, solar panels, and other means of alternative forms of energy. We need tens of millions of solar panels right now, and there is an eager and skilled workforce who can build them. Number eight, provide tax incentives for those who travel by hybrid car or bus or train. Also credits for those who convert their home to alternative energy. And number nine, to help pay for this, impose a $2 tax on every gallon of gasoline. This will get people to switch to more energy-saving cars or to use the new rail lines and rail cars the former auto workers have built for them. All right, well, those are ideas from Michael Moore. You can find the full text of that letter on michaelmoore.com. And, you know, I think those are great ideas. And this is a tremendous opportunity. Yeah, huge companies going bankrupt, I guess that could be seen as bad news, but it could also be seen as an opportunity. And it would be great if we used it as such, as an opportunity to move into the 21st century or maybe into the 20th century. 45 years ago, the bullet train started in Japan. That's just sad. I don't know. You think it's a possibility? I hope so. I really do. Okay, let's quickly go through the things that have been happening in the world. You hear about this? Another friendly fire incident in New York City. Police officer shot to death by another officer. You know, as soon as I heard this, and I don't want to sound too cynical, but as soon as I heard this, I knew it was a black cop shot by a white cop because it always is. It always happens that way. Find me one instance of a white cop being shot to death by a black cop. It doesn't happen. Now, he wasn't in uniform, granted, and used that same criteria to see if you find any examples of the opposite holding true. This was somebody who was apparently chasing someone who had broken into his car, and he had his gun in the air. I don't know if he identified himself. I wasn't there. I don't know if the other cops identified themselves. But the point is, this mentality that you see somebody running down the street, even if they have a gun in the air, that you have to kill them immediately before you know any of the facts. I mean, look at all the movies that have come out. And think of how many times the hero is running down the street, not wearing a police uniform, with a gun in the air. Would you kill him every single time without question? Obviously not. I'm not in favor of people running down the street holding guns in the air, mind you. But this whole mentality of shoot first, ask questions later, it's wrong. It's been proven wrong so many times, and it's just indication of the poor training that goes on, where cops believe that's the only way to deal with the situation. How many times have we seen completely innocent civilians gunned down for no particular reason? Because they didn't do the right thing at the right moment, and this cop that has all this armament and bulletproof vests and things like that thought his life was in danger. And what was it, a naked man on a fire escape? They had to kill him because he was moving towards them in a threatening way. Unreal. We need better ways of dealing with situations. Here's another example from Detroit, speaking of the Motor City. Robert Mitchell died April 10th in an abandoned house in Warren, just across 8 Mile Road from Detroit proper. Police said the teen was resisting arrest after bolting from his cousin's car during a traffic stop. And they used a taser on him. The taser killed him. Yes, tasers do kill. What they had done was, the Warren police had pulled over Mitchell's cousin for having an expired license plate. And that's when Mitchell jumped out and started running. Apparently he had been completely spooked by cops in the past, and he panicked. And I know what that feeling is like. I know what that feeling is like, even after spending a minimal amount of time in the lockup, under not nearly as stressful situations as most people in that situation have to deal with. You still feel the panic even seeing them walking down the street or seeing a cop car behind you. You feel like you have to control yourself and prevent yourself from panicking and doing something stupid like running or bolting or driving away really fast. But this was a 16-year-old kid. And apparently he wasn't able to control himself as much, and he ran. And running cost him his life because, well, you see a kid running, you have to run after him, right? You have to do everything you can to stop him, even though you don't know who he is. You don't know why he's running. You just assume that he's running for a reason. And yeah, that's not entirely illogical to assume that he might have something to hide. But you know what? You've got the guy driving the car. You can always find out who that other person was at a later point. They ordered him several times not to resist, and he continued to resist. You ever try that? You ever try telling somebody, don't resist? I'm holding you to the ground, but don't resist. Kind of goes against instincts, you know? So, the police say they had no alternative but to use what they felt at the time was non-lethal force. You know, we all know tasers are not non-lethal force. Why is it cops don't know this? All right. Getting back to the NYPD officer who was killed by another cop, this brings us to another story of a representative, Charles Rangel. He got himself in a bit of hot water because he was asked by a reporter as he left a ribbon-cutting ceremony at Hudson River Park on Saturday, what should President Obama do during his visit to New York? Which is already over. He's on his way to Egypt now. That's going to be interesting. The congressman who had been reminiscing at the podium about his boyhood when he took the 125th Street trolley to the piers to watch the boats responded with an apparent off-the-cuff quip. I love those. Make certain he doesn't run around in East Harlem without identification. Yeah. And that was an allusion to the fatal shooting of the black off-duty police officer by a white officer. And basically, the tabloids were all over it, saying even Obama may not be safe, says Rangel. And Rangel's sick joke, the New York Post said. By midday, Michael Bloomberg had weighed in. I have a lot of respect for Charlie Rangel, but in this case, he's just plain wrong. This was a tragedy. Our police department is diverse, and they train. Sometimes things happen, and they're inexplicable. There's no reason to suspect this had any racial overtones. Okay, again, let's see the instances of this happening to white people. It doesn't happen. Happens to people standing in their own lobbies, holding up wallets. They get mowed down. Happens all the time. Yeah, it doesn't happen every day. But all the time, if it happens once a year, that's enough to define it as all the time when people are being killed for no reason. Anyway, the upset over Mr. Rangel's remark reflected the high tension and racial sensitivity surrounding the shooting of Officer Omar Edwards in East Harlem Thursday night, another chapter in the history of fraternal police shootings across the color line. Earlier, Mr. Rangel had called for a federal investigation of the shooting, saying that an independent inquiry would help assure the minority community that what happened was a mistake and that such an encounter would not happen again. Yeah, well, we'll see about that. And here's something kind of weird and bizarre. I was having trouble even comprehending this, but I said last week, you know, we shouldn't pay any attention to what Dick Cheney says. But he said something yesterday that blew me away, and I had to pay attention. He said yesterday he supports gays being able to marry, but believes states, not the federal government, should make the decision. He said, I think, you know, freedom means freedom for everyone. I think people ought to be free to enter into any kind of union they wish, any kind of arrangement they wish. I think that's the way it ought to be handled today, that is, on a state-by-state basis. Different states will make different decisions. I don't have any problem with that. I think people ought to get a shot at that. Wow, this is unbelievable. He's more to the left than Obama on this issue, if you can even consider it a left-right issue. But definitely it's more of a liberal issue, I would say, right? Not many conservatives would have that view. So, yeah, hats off. I mean, he has a gay daughter, so hopefully she's been doing her work and getting him to come round. And this is exactly what I was talking about last week, where you have to get people to change how they feel, to think about it, to understand why what they believed in was wrong. And that's really the best way to make the change. Not simply to overturn a decision and force it upon people. You have to get the people to change. So, wow, this is something. But, you know, we still have a lot to disagree with Mr. Cheney there, for instance, you know, torture and things like that. And you hear about this story. This was interesting, too. There's this shock jock, a talk show host, who decided that he wanted to try waterboarding. He's a fairly popular conservative libertarian morning talk show host. And it took him 6 seconds to change his mind. Witnesses said that Eric Mueller thrashed on the table and even instantly threw the toy cow he was holding as his emergency tool to signify when he wanted the experiment to stop. Only lasted 6 or 7 seconds. It is way worse than I thought it would be, and that's no joke, said the shock jock known as Man Cow. He likened it to a time when he nearly drowned as a child. It is such an odd feeling to have water poured down your nose with your head back. It was instantaneous, and I don't want to say this, absolutely torture. I wanted to prove it wasn't torture. They cut off our heads, we put water on their face. I got voted to do this, but I really thought, I'm going to laugh this off. Yeah, so that's interesting right there. And of course, we've probably all heard the story about the doctor who was murdered in Kansas, George Tiller, a Wichita doctor who was one of the few doctors in the nation who perform late-term abortions. But, you know, they're all saying this in the media. It wasn't like a recreational thing for him. It was done in the case where the mother would probably die if she gave birth. But even with that, he was still one of relatively few doctors who did this. He was shot to death Sunday as he attended church. He was shot to death inside the church. Incredible. He was also, in 1993, shot in both arms by an abortion opponent, but he recovered from that. And police say the shots were fired from a handgun in the church lobby during the morning service. Pretty disturbing story. But what was most disturbing about this was the fact that the guy who did this had a history, a disturbing history. His name was Scott Roeder. And in fact, there's even video of him being sentenced, I think back in 1996. Now, his family life began unraveling more than a decade ago when he got involved with anti-government groups. Nothing wrong with that so much, but it's where it took him. He then became very religious in an Old Testament eye-for-an-eye way. That's according to his former wife. The anti-tax stuff came first, and then it grew and grew. He became very anti-abortion. And that's all he cared about. He made comments, apparently. Someone using his name, at least, made comments on anti-abortion websites, including one that referred to the doctor as the concentration camp Mengele of our day, a reference to the Nazi doctor who performed ghastly medical experiments on Jews and others at Auschwitz. The posting said Dr. Tiller needs to be stopped before he and those who protect him bring judgment upon our nation. And here's a piece from somebody who interviewed his father back in 1996, from Tim Rencher. He says, I asked Scott Roeder's father if his son was capable of killing someone back in 1996. Scott would not kill a fly, John Roeder replied. He won't step on a worm. So how could he possibly, unless he was being used by somebody, be planning anything that would take human life? Today, meaning 1996, actually, no, he's shooting ahead to the present. Today he is behind bars, awaiting the filing of charges in Sunday's gunshot slaying of Dr. George Tiller. But it was his anti-government sentiments that led to Scott Roeder being arrested in April 1996 when the Shawnee County Sheriff's Office found ammunition and a blasting cap in his car after stopping it because it didn't have a legal license plate. Instead, the car bore a plate indicating the driver was a sovereign citizen and immune from law. Yeah, remember that? That's what Timothy McVeigh had after he blew up Oklahoma City. He had one of those license plates. Didn't believe he had to have a license plate. Not the smartest thing to do if you're committing crimes or if blowing things up. Anyway, Roeder was subsequently convicted of criminal use of explosives before the Kansas Court of Appeals overturned that conviction. Yeah, I'd like to know more details about that. Anyway, he apparently had gotten involved with the Montana Freemen. Remember them? That was also in 1996. They had that standoff with the feds over in Montana about taxes and property liens and license plates and guns, all sorts of fun things like that. And this guy apparently was buying into that and loaded his car up with explosives and didn't put on a license plate, got caught, and somehow was let go. And I'd like to know, was the gun he was carrying, was he allowed to have that gun? Somebody with this kind of history, is this the kind of person that really should be walking around, you know, with weaponry? Sometimes you have to have restrictions. Can't just hand them out to everybody. Unreal. And then you had this other shooting that took place at a recruiting center in Little Rock, Arkansas. Now, it's interesting how these two stories are being treated a little bit differently. They're talking about this guy who recently converted to Islam, who shot and killed a U.S. soldier at the recruiting booth in Little Rock, and he had ties to a number of global locations linked to extremists. Yeah. So, Abdulkarim Mujahid Muhammad is being called a terrorist. In fact, he's even being charged with terrorist attack because he shot a gun at an occupied building. Do you know that's all it takes? That's a terrorist attack. Fair enough, you know. It causes terror. It's obviously you're doing this to make some kind of political change, which I think is one of the other qualifications for terrorism. So how come they're not calling this other guy who murdered the doctor inside a church, which I believe was an occupied building, they're not saying terrorist there? They're not charging him with the same kind of thing. You know, these are two very big wrongs. But it's extremists on both sides. All right. Shall we take some phone calls? Let's do that in the time we have left. Shoot into delay, and we'll be right back. Our phone number, 631-632-9872.
Hi, this is Kyle from Rainer Maria, and you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook 90.1 FM. Hi, this is Kyle from Rainer Maria, and you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook 90.1 FM.
You know what? I know why it's not working, because somebody changed something here about the way delay works. You know what? The silence is unavoidable. I have to walk over to the other side of the room and fix something. I don't know why I have to do these things, but I'm going to do it anyway. Sorry for the silence. Okay, I have to plug something in now because just having a switch is too easy. I can't see. Oh, there we go. It's funny, too, because I was saying how this was the smoothest transition. I was assuming that it would be a smooth transition. All right, I'm going to play what I played again, and we'll try this one more time.
Hi, this is Kyle from Rainer Maria, and you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook 90.1 FM.
I'm sorry about that. I really am. Yeah, you know, trying to make sure everything is working in this place is really frustrating. Okay, 631-632-9872 is our phone number. Let's get a couple of calls on the line. If you have any questions, comments, information for us, maybe you have some details as to what that music was we played before, just some comments on some of the things we've been talking about. Good evening. You're on Off the Wall.
Yes, hello, Emmanuel.
Hi, where are you calling from?
Calling from South Pawtucket.
All right, nearby.
Yes, sir.
What's on your mind?
It's actually your old friend Kibret.
Oh, wow. Oh, this is amazing. I can't believe it. So do you actually know who that was?
Absolutely. In fact, I turned on the radio and said, who is so cool that he's playing the Rastafarians with a song called Occupation?
Wow, that's who it is, the Rastafarians. You know, I plugged in the lyrics onto Google, and nothing came up. And I had a friend hold up his iPhone to try and recognize the music. That didn't work. So you have this knowledge in your head.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I was in the car, I just turned it on the radio, and there was a song.
Wow, that's great. Well, it's great to hear from you again. I haven't talked to you in a long time.
I know, but I'm listening every week, man.
Wow, and I hear you on occasionally when I'm driving around, and you're still doing the Thursday thing, right?
Thursday and Friday night, yeah.
Wow, incredible. What time exactly? Give us.
Actually, Thursday night's from 10 to midnight.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the dance hall reggae.
Yeah.
Hardcore stuff, and then Friday, 7 to 9.
Every Friday?
Just about. I alternate with the Ital Doctor and Jesse Irie, but most weekends I'm there.
Yeah, yeah. And I listen to your show, and it keeps me in the car because I don't want to leave.
Yeah. Well, that's how I feel about your show.
Oh, great. Well, I'm going to have to leave pretty soon, but listen, let's catch up sometime. And
take some more calls, but I just want to let you know that was the song.
Rastafarians. Well, I'm going to download that legally, too, as soon as I get home.
Good, man.
Thanks for the info. And that's great. Wow. Didn't have to rely on technology. Just had to rely on good old human smarts there. I think maybe that should be a lesson for all of us. 631-632-9872. Good evening. You're on Off the Wall.
Emmanuel, how's it going?
Hi. Where are you calling from?
Miller Place.
Miller Place. Another local call. Great. What's on your mind?
Far from you. I was listening to the program, as always. And, Tim McVeigh supposedly... the reason the plate was off of his car was it was removed by his handlers. Supposedly there was quite a few other people involved.
Mm-hmm.
Were said to even be operatives within our own government that using him as he was almost a patsy, and supposedly they took the plate off his car intentionally so that he would be stopped.
Interesting. Well, that's a theory for sure, but it doesn't seem to have gone anywhere, right?
Of course, everything is open to discussion. I'm no authority on any of these topics, but I do know that he wasn't intentionally driving around without a plate on the car. And as I said, it was almost as though it was almost like what happened supposedly with the man who was framed supposedly for assassinating Kennedy, you know?
Uh-huh.
They use these people. And actually, you know, if it's in the somewhere in a congressional record where somebody was trying to get documents released pertaining to, remember initially with the Oklahoma bombing, there was another man had a firm description of that was never even...
Well, there was a guy from Michigan, the guy who was part of the Michigan militia.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was never talked about afterwards, and then there was...
Well, there was a guy who was put in, I forget his name at the moment, but he was put in jail for helping Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah, you're thinking of the guy that helped him with the fertilizer and all that.
Yeah,
that was another guy entirely.
Uh-huh.
But on that very day, I think the guy's name was Terry Nichols you're talking about.
Terry Nichols, that's the guy, yeah.
Never, he was, this isn't the guy, this is somebody totally...
Well, at the very beginning, they were talking about Arab people doing it as well. I mean, they always get it wrong at the beginning.
Yeah, it's really, it's very Orwellian, the whole... Everything that's gone on, and like you said before, the way that they label various crimes. In one subject, it's terrorism, and then in another instance, it's something else. I mean, they use doublespeak with everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look in the Mideast, one country does something, and it's a response to something the other country or the other group of people did, and then those other people do something, that's terrorism.
Well, one man's terrorism is a terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Right. I mean, in no instance is it justified, and I'm not trying to do that, but...
Nor am I. Right. I don't know what to believe anymore, but
I know that's good. That, you're in a good state if you can say that, because I think we should all be in that state where we don't know what to believe anymore, because maybe then we'll have some new beliefs and new ways of thinking.
Yeah, well, I think we all need to come together and try to resolve most of our issues in more of a diplomatic way than I see these days.
Mm-hmm.
I feel as though we're all like, we're at each other's throat. Whether it's Republican, Democrat, I mean, it's like, what do they say, divide and conquer?
Yeah, the best way to do that is to reach out to your enemy, you know, the person that you think is really the worst person on earth or is out to get you and, you know, hasn't actually done anything really horrible to you yet, but some kind of gesture where, you know, you're not the worst person in the world and, you know, like maybe we could say something nice to the guy from Iran or the guy from North Korea, something like that, and get them to just calm down a little bit, and then we can actually get some progress made.
Sure. We can only hope, but from what I've seen these days, it's gone crazy. I mean, there is no justice for any one of us. It's all about greed and the race to the bottom. And I think we're just about there.
Oh, we're gonna win that race, I think. Anyway, thanks for your call.
Oh, well, let me make one other point.
Yeah, quickly.
On Flight 800, you had also stated that you thought that it might have been a meteor. Or
yeah, I mean, I think that's as good a.
It's a fact. Now, this I know for certain. My friend is an air traffic controller, and he was on duty that night. And it's a fact that plane was taken down by a missile.
Well, I'm acquainted with that theory as well.
Well, it's not a theory. It's a fact. And there's a gentleman by the name of Tom Stalkup, who's an expert, or, you know, he's a former aviation investigator.
Okay, but you see, history books decide what are facts. The history books don't always say the right things, but the history books are not going to say that was a missile.
Victors, and, you know, you can't necessarily trust those in power to tell you the truth.
I'm just saying how history is going to remember it, and there's a bit more work to do if you want the history books to say it was a missile.
Yeah, well, like I said, my friend said that they saw it on their radar on that very evening. That it went up, I think it was around 8 o'clock in the evening, and he said that every controller on duty saw it, and they said that's what it was. And, in fact, on the following morning, they recorded, they had some stuff that had been erased intentionally that shouldn't have been erased, which would have pointed to that fact. And then Pierre Salinger pointed out a few...
I remember all this like it was yesterday, but we're going to have devote a lot more time to it if we're going to have a discussion about Flight 800, because that's much information to go through.
But thank you very much, and I do enjoy your program every Tuesday.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
And that's just about all the time we have for phone calls tonight. Yeah, wow, how about that? I'm talking twice at once. We're just about out of time. But, I mentioned North Korea. I just wanted to say a couple of things. Apparently, Kim Jong-il is signaling who his successor will be. His youngest son is probably going to be heir to the monarchy. South Korean media said today that as the rival Koreas build up their forces along a disputed sea border, the youngest son. Now, I'm not really sure. I don't know that much about him. I'm going to try and learn as much as possible over the next few days or so. Kim Jong-un, was born either in 83 or 84, educated in Switzerland. Intelligence sources said he appears to be the most capable of Kim's three known sons. But even by North Korea standards, very little is known about him. And that's going to be interesting to see what happens. More interesting, though, and more immediate, is the big game coming up. Oh, you know about the big game, don't you? Yeah, World Cup. World Cup qualifiers are still happening, and... North Korea is it's one of the teams to keep your eye on. They're playing. Let's see, who are they playing here? They've reached the final qualifying round for the second time in a row. North Koreans are the team to watch in this tough-looking group. That's according to a FIFA analysis. They boast the meanest defense of the final 10, having not conceded a single goal in the previous round. And their counterattacks will be orchestrated by Serbian-based playmaker Hong Young-jo. Now they're in a group with South Korea, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the United Arab Emirates. They're right now in second place. South Korea is in first place with 11 points. Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea, is in second place with 10 points, tied actually with Saudi Arabia with 10 points. So Let's see what the schedule holds. Games coming up this week. And we got to see if we can find this on television someplace. North Korea will be playing Iran on the 6th. The 6th of June. Where's that calendar? Calendar still says May. Hang on. That'll be Saturday. Okay. So that game is on Saturday. And then they're also going to be playing... let's see. Is that all they're playing? Okay, that's all I see on this schedule. They're playing Iran in Pyongyang. So if they win that, they could advance. They could advance to the World Cup. Wouldn't that be something? Not since 1968 has that happened. Wow. Okay, well, that kind of thing can change the mood of a cranky leader, and the whole world could benefit as a result. Something to think about for those people on the Iranian team who don't have a chance anyway. How important is this game to you? All right, we're out of time. I want to thank people for calling in and writing in. OTW@2600.com. See you next week. Good night.
Would you like to go with me down my dead end street? Would you like to come with me to village ghetto land? See the people lock their doors while robbers laugh and steal. Beggars watch and eat their meals from garbage cans. Broken glass is everywhere, it's a bloody scene. Killing plagues the citizens, unless they own police. Children play with rusted cars, swords cover their hands. Politicians laugh and drink, drunk to all demands. Families buying dog food now, starvation roams the street. Babies die before they're born, infected by the greed. Now some folks say that we should be glad for what we have. Tell me, would you be happy? Village ghetto land.
Kids, you're listening to WUSB in Stony Brook. That was Stevie Wonder from Songs in the Keys of Life, in the Key of Life.